I remember my dad yelling in frustration at the television set at our beloved Chicago Cubs, who were in the middle of yet another whatever, blown save, blown game, blown playoff. It didn't seem to matter. He would be so frustrated, and I would think, what is the point? What was the point of getting angry at the Chicago Cubs? Getting angry at the Chicago Cubs losing is a little bit like buying a ticket for the lottery, going out, getting a new car, sure that you will soon have the money to pay the payments. Let me continue with this Cubs metaphor for a moment. It's easy to become cynical being a Chicago Cubs fan. Or at least that's what I thought the meaning of cynical was. I was thinking that cynical meant sort of just giving up and thinking that things are never really going to work out, not having any faith, not just the religious kind. I mean, like, oh, those Cubs, they're never going to win the World Series. But listen to the definition of the word cynical. Contemptuously distrustful of human nature and motives, and based on or reflecting a belief that human conduct is motivated primarily by self-interest. Wow. This is much bigger than being from Chicago or giving up on baseball. This is a core feeling that comes when one becomes distrustful of human nature and human motives and believing that human conduct is primarily motivated by self-interest. And this brings the meaning of cynical to a whole new level. It makes me wonder how we get to that level of hopelessness or frustration. And you don't have to look too far in today's world, and I would make a list, but I've made a lot of those lists lately, and it depresses me. I guess the thing that really strikes me about being cynical is that you have to have gotten to a place where you believe, what is the point? And I don't doubt that that's an easy place to go to sometimes. I hear people say all the time that they feel like it's hard to decide how to do something in the midst of all the overwhelming needs that come our way. And sometimes when you do something, you're met with somebody else's cynicism or anger, and it kind of tips your scale in the other direction. Well, often I think that cynicism is a close cousin to being realistic. One definition of realistic is concern for fact or reality and rejection of the impractical or visionary. Rejection of the impractical or visionary. And sometimes I feel like this is the world that we live in, and I don't mean that as a compliment. Of course, I think it's important for us to assess fact and reality. For instance, a fact would be that the Chicago Cubs have not won a World Series since 1945. And they've not won a World Series since 1908. Laugh if you will. For those who aren't doing the math, that's 107 years. And although that is the fact, we from Chicago know in our hearts the saying that comes true for every Cub fan, there's always next year. Candace, bless your heart. Now, I've talked before about Rabbi Michael Lerner and his thoughts on being realistic, and basically this is what he said. The most significant changes in the U.S. in the past 50 years were won because people fought for ideals that were universally seen as unrealistic. When their struggles began, the struggle against segregation and forced civil rights for minorities, the struggle against patriarchy and discrimination against women, the struggle for GLBT rights, the struggle for the rights of the disabled, all of these struggles were dismissed as unrealistic, he said. He said over and over again, people have been told that the politics is art of the possible, and therefore they should give up the highest vision of good and fight for what is realistic. But history actually teaches us a different message, that you never know what is possible until you fight for what is desirable. Because in that struggle, many desirable goals that seem impossible to begin with appear quite possible. As more and more people struggle to achieve a more humane and ethically and spiritually rational world. Now, as many of you know, I saw the movie Selma this week. I'm going to be talking a lot about Selma in the coming month. The first week in March, I'm going to Selma. I'm going to participate in the conference sponsored by the UUA, the Unitarian Universalist Association, to celebrate and honor the 50th anniversary of the crossing of the Edmund Pettus Bridge. I'm going to be celebrating that, I guess, that march to Montgomery with thousands of people, and I just heard that President Obama is planning on being there. I'll leave much of what I have to say about this until I get closer to that date because I'm planning some services about this event. But let me say this, the March on Selma and the desire to gain voting rights for black voters in the South and throughout America was not a cynical movement, and it was far from being stuck in realistic. In my opinion, there is a difference between realistic and real. Theologian and another one of my life teachers, Walter Wink, says, It is in my own self interest to recognize that my opponents have jobs and mortgages that tie them to the existing political and economic system. They are afraid of losing their grip on the world, and they need to be reassured that revolution will not strip them of all means of making a livelihood and all their hard-won security. To me, that's being real about people and facts in the world, because there are ideologies and philosophies and theologies that are very different than ours. There are cultures of all kinds that are not what any of us are used to or what we may find comfortable. And being real is understanding they exist. Being real is trying to assess and understand the facts. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke about why hope. And today I ask the question, what is the point? Why try to make a difference that may include what may be impractical or visionary? Wink talks about this as it relates to movements of social justice. He points out that it is about fundamental justice, a theme of nonviolent movements in history, and perhaps a significant difference from movements of violent struggle. And this is highlighted by the difference between the need for victory and the desire for fundamental rights and justice. A good lesson for us all, I think, because when Wink talks about this, he cites the Reverend James Bevel, a colleague of Dr. King's. And when James Bevel talked about the situation that needs for us to call for the love of one's enemies, he said, "We are not just fighting for our rights, but for the good of the whole society." For the good of the whole society. And part of what the point is that at some point, someone has to lay aside their own specific self-interest and fight for the good of the whole society. Everyone involved to be raised up, to be healed, and to be whole. And this is different than victory. And in many ways, what I believe Dr. King was fighting for with his nonviolent direct action. Wink also said that the means are commensurate with the new order. The means are commensurate with the new order. And this is almost the same as what Gandhi said, be the change you want to see. It's also about the transformation of relationships versus the transfer of power. This is demonstrated well by another Gandhi quote, when speaking about the possible use of violence toward the British in their fight for independence. And Gandhi said, "We've come a long way with the British. When they eventually leave, we want them to do so as friends." Another part of the point is to look inward in this process, to reflect on yourself and your part in it, and tend on our own souls, for Walter Wink also reminds us that resistance can take its toll, and to be avoided, turning into one who is fighting, there needs to be a commitment to doing the inner work necessary to stay spiritually fit. Because he says, what a wonderful and expansive feeling it is to denounce evil grandly, especially an evil so unequivocal as something like apartheid. What a host of oversights and sins are covered by such greasy goodness. How nice we feel about ourselves. In such a mood, it's easy to fall into the us-them thinking, to forget our own complicity in our past complicity toward the evil we now so tardily oppose, he says. He says this because he believes that we all have the capacity to be complacent and compliant with these kinds of evils. And in talking about the white South Africans who supported the black South Africans, they were still beneficiaries of apartheid, subtle and direct. In 1950s and 60s America, there were many white liberals that benefited from our version of apartheid that didn't rush to Dr. King's side. Wink feels that this potential for evil or to reflect the darkness of the oppressor is something inside all of us. It's something that's difficult to admit, but it's an essential component of resisting the shadow side of the systems of power and privilege. To reflect on these things in ourselves, people who engage in nonviolent protest without at least some awareness of this possible cesspool of violence within them, he says, can actually jeopardize the lives of their compatriots. I've often thought about this while watching peace rallies. Because although, as someone brought up to me in the break between services, there are sometimes instigators in those rallies who incite violence, there are many people who go to those peace rallies and start screaming at the top of their lungs that they want peace. And it turns into angry, violent rhetoric, shouting, and mob-like behaviors. And it doesn't really matter to me how those start, but they don't feel much like a peace rally when they happen. Yes, there will always be struggles we face, all kinds of challenges. And of course, there are times when we must face it, that the world can be a difficult place with tragic events possible. And part of the point is not to get sucked into these polarities that we so often paint so easily by so many. There are plenty of times that we need to take a stand for evil when it's too much to bear. But we need to be careful about the certainty of our own right and wrong. We're so cut and dried sometimes about our opinions. We're spoon-fed these 30-second sound bites that capture a very superficial explanation of the nuances and the details of any experience. Life is so much more nuanced than we hear in those sound bites, and we need to listen and engage more and take more risks, perhaps. And as I said earlier in the year, be willing to stand together out on the edge. We will fall into cynicism. We will certainly deal with bout after bout of realism. But hope calls to us with creative nuance to the possible. And if we don't go there, we never will know. I think that my point is of asking, what's the point? As if we don't go there, we never will know. We have to take the seed. We have to give it water, and we have to give it love. We have to take the dream. We have to give it courage, and we have to give it love. You have to take this song, the song of hope and love, and give it strength and time. Please give it strength and time. We're not just fighting for our rights, but for the good of the whole society. And there are different strategies for us to transform our conflicts and differences in the world. But we often, so often try just what we know, or what we're comfortable with, or what we've seen happen before. And although it seems perhaps naive at times, there is always next year. There is always the possible. Each and every April, it is possible that the Cubs can end the season in October as World Series champions. May that be so. Amen.